Well, good morning, everyone, and thanks everyone for coming along to this presentation today. Hopefully it was my elevator presentation that did it for you. My name's Matt Dell. I'm a National Account Manager at Fidelity International, and always happy to talk about the Fidelity India Fund for anyone who's interested in talking about that. But this morning we're here to hear a little bit more from Dr. Anand Sethi. Many of you will have seen Dr. Sethi speak yesterday afternoon, and hopefully you found the presentation entertaining and enjoyable. But I think the thing with India is it's fair to say it hasn't attracted from an investment point of view, hasn't attracted the same amount of press as China has, but it does enjoy the same sort of economic growth around the 10% mark, and the stock market has been in bull market territory for some 4.5 years now, so it's been very, very strong for a long time. But that's about where the similarity with China ends. You know, I think where China's taken a fairly traditional route to its industrialisation through basic manufacturing, India's really bypassed that. And I think you may hear some more about that from Anand today. But India's really concentrated more on the heavy manufacturing and the service industries, which of course has had the profile here. You know, probably one of the themes of a lot of India presentations is that, you know, whereas the industrialization has created wealth through manufacturing or oil, India's creating its wealth through the human mind. And that's very much, I think that will very much come out of the presentation today. The other thing with India is that the population is the youngest in the world, and it's getting younger. I mean, their baby boom is continuing. So as I heard Anand say the other day, you know, as developed nations age, it's India that's going to provide the workers of the future. As I said earlier in my elevator presentation, I think there's a real perception that this story is about IT, software, back office processing, and call centres. And they certainly have the profile, those industries, but they only employ about 1 million Indians. So that sort of leaves 1.1 million Indians to account for. So there's a lot more to this than meets the eye. I think that's probably one of the messages that we like to get out there. Anand's bio is in your kits there, so I'll leave you to read that. But he has a very distinguished career as a pioneer of the IT industry in India. He's an author of a book. He's a businessman. He's worked with a lot of businesses in India and I think in the US, helping them set up business in India. And as Graham Rich and David Thomas pointed out, he's our Indian guru. He spent a couple of days with us on the BRIC India study tour that we went on earlier this year. And for those of you who are considering perhaps going on one of those BRIC study tours, be it in China or India, I highly recommend it, because everyone that I know that's been on any of those tours comes back pretty much converted as to what's going on. So the presentation today is the Rent-A-Brain Supermart, and without any further ado, I'm going to introduce Dr. Anand Sethi.
Well, good morning, folks. I'll just take a few seconds by way of introduction for those who were not present last evening when I did my first presentation. The Rent-A-Brain Supermart is a phrase that I take pleasure in saying that I have coined that. It's a bit corny, perhaps, but it sort of sums up what I'm going to talk about today. The background to this, of course, is that India's model of growth is a little different from some of those in our neighborhood. We are not into making lousy cheap toys or bad toothpaste or exploding tires. We leave it to others to do. References made, well, it's only 1 odd million jobs that get created in the high-tech sector, but there is a linkage. Our manufacturing sector actually is growing much faster than some of our IT and services sectors. And of course, the manufacturing is usually high-tech, high-value-added, with a great element of design and development going into that. I mean, for example, as I mentioned yesterday, many elements of the design of the Dreamliner Boeing 787 or the Airbus 350 gets done in India and, of course, gets converted into the supply chain components for these aircraft. And there are many other such examples, but let me not waste time on that. Let me get into my main presentation. You know, for years, India was called this plodding elephant, and those of you who saw my presentation yesterday, finally this elephant has begun to dance. But the dance actually came into prominence when the Indian IT scene was recognized by the world. We'll see where this recognition came from, but I thought I would use the Holy Bible as a reference point. Oh, blessed are the meek, the geeks in our case, for they shall inherit the earth. I have used here, which pretty much sums up the role of India's IT geeks. It's a cover from one of our major publications called India Today that ran a special story. I love that little piece, you know. Right, let's get on to the main presentation. We can have an open question and answer comment session after that. So for decades after independence, India was pilloried for a very poor GDP growth rate of 2 to 3%, while the tiger economies were booming. We were under the influence of the USSR. Everybody said, what the heck are you guys doing? You're setting up all these white elephant-type educational institutions, research institutions. None of this is coming into play to improve your GDP. You're producing unemployed graduates. It's a disaster. Yeah, maybe it looks like that at that point in time. So many, many caustic comments had been made about India, by all kinds of people, about Indians as well, and the most famous one I thought I would reproduce here. I don't want to read that out. There are some dot, dot, dots, but this was made by President, at that time, Richard Nixon. Well, guess what happened? Revenge of the nerds, ladies and gentlemen. I have reproduced this quotation. It's a very famous one. It's actually by a schoolmate of mine who's chairman of one of our largest IT companies called NIIT, which actually has operations here in Australia. It's also the world's largest IT educational institution. The West created wealth through the Industrial Revolution, West Asia through oil. Now it is India's turn to create wealth using the human mind. Let's go back a little into history. The Vedas, the books, the ancient texts, describe knowledge as wealth. Every Indian family believes in saving money, scrimping, scrounging, so they can educate their children, because that is wealth. In the old days, medical sciences, astronomy, metallurgy flourished in ancient India. Ancient India laid the foundations of modern arithmetic, algebra, geometry, trigonometry. India gave the world the Arabic numerals. I mean, they called them Arabic because the Arab traders who came on the overland route took it from India for their masters in the West, controlled by the merchants of Venice. India gave the world the concept of zero, the decimal system, concepts of fractions, square, cube roots, much to the disgust of current-day students. The minus sign and the calculation of pi was first done in India. The very first software program, if we can define software programs as logical statements for problem solving, I mean, today they're called software, but they were written in India as early as 476 AD. And the guy who wrote the first one is a fellow called Bhaskara. Modern IT came into existence when India invested in its educational R&D institutions after independence. Everybody said, these are white elephants. They're not going to help your economy. You need to mass produce cheap products for exports. We thought a little differently. Let's just go briefly into the history of the Indian software industry. It's only as late as 1956 that India purchased its first digital computer. It was installed in the Indian Statistical Institute in Calcutta. I put a little plug here. 1963, my institute, this is the Indian Institute of Technology in Bombay. At that time, we didn't like the Americans. We didn't like America. We didn't like the British. So we got our first computer from Russia. It was called the Riyadh. It was a cheap copy of an IBM 360, but it was a computer. In 1974, India conducted its first nuclear test. Everybody knows about the recent ones in 1998, but actually the first ones were done in 1974. And the world introduced sanctions against India. No computers were available, no software was available. So we decided that we were going to do this ourselves. In 1975, India established its first computer hardware program, self-reliance, with some help from the USSR and France. Bear in mind that in the old days, and I'm sure that happened in Australia as well, when you bought a computer system, you paid for the hardware. The software used to be bundled in pretty much free of charge. It's now changed the other way around. It's the software which is the more important part. Sometimes you can give away the hardware. And again, in 1974, India's largest software company called TCS, or Tata Computers, was established and started exports of IT services. These are low-cost services for data collection and whatever. And they started exporting to boroughs of the United States. In the year 1977, there was a major political change in India. Mrs. Gandhi's government was defeated, and the new government, comprising of a coalition of leftists and also rightists, decided that, well, we need to kick out these foreigners once again. They're messing around in our country. So this government expelled IBM and ICL and laid off all their IT engineers. Without jobs, what did they do? Also, at that time, the high cost of imported hardware, whether it was France or Russia or wherever, we couldn't afford to buy them. We already had sanctions, so we couldn't even get the real computers that one wanted. So these laid-off IT engineers came up with a solution. They said, well, we'll take these small computers, try and link them together, and we'll write some new software. Ladies and gentlemen, India gave the world computer networking. We couldn't afford the large computers. They were not being sold to India. So I said, all right, we'll take the PDP-8s. I don't know if you recall the old Digital Equipment Corporation. PDP-8s, PDP-10s, put them together, made them work as a network. In 1982, software companies that were formed to do this work increased exports to pay for foreign exchange they had borrowed. It was very difficult to get foreign exchange in India. And then we had a rather modern-thinking prime minister called Rajiv Gandhi, who was an airline pilot, and he said, well, you know, this looks like a good sector to encourage. So foreign exchange was made available to Indian companies to go out and buy whatever hardware they could get in the international market. And that sort of perked up this business of IT, just starting at that time in 1984, and some intrepid companies called British Airways, Swiss Air, Citibank, they set up IT backup operations in India, basically for doing airline ticket clearances and, you know, fare calculations. And it was in 1986 that the first American company called Texas Instruments established its 100% export software unit in our city of Bangalore, which, of course, as you now know, is the world's IT capital. Shortly thereafter, Hewlett-Packard established a similar unit. And then, in 1991, the government of India decided that they would establish what we call software technology parks, which are basically special economic zones. There are no import duties. There are no other cesses or whatever, basically for you to do IT work and then export it. Well, out of the blue, in 1992, Swiss Bundesbahn, the Swiss Federal Railways, floated a global tender to revamp their whole IT system. And this company from India called TCS, which we have just noted, in a global bid was selected by Swiss Bundesbahn. And believe it or not, they completed this in record time. They completed this whole job 1 year before they were expected to do so. And till date, there were zero bugs, not a single bug in that whole IT system for Swiss Bundesbahn, which, as you know, is the world's most precise railway system in terms of running on time. So here were these, what were called the techno-coolies, you know, doing these cheap stuff work. But they were now suddenly a class act. Good Lord. People say, how could these Indian guys do this? You know, I mean, this is Swiss Federal Railways. But as a result of the reputation that Indian IT engineers acquired at that time, you know, 1995, 96, the world began to panic. Oh, year 2000 is approaching. This world is going to collapse. What's going to happen? This Y2K doomsday business is coming on our heads. Nobody knew how to fix this. So the word went out, get those Indian guys, let them come and see if they can fix this business. And of course, you know, Y2K was solved to the satisfaction of everybody. And then, for the year 2000, the Euro business was coming in, you know, the computer keyboards, etc. Now, there's no mention of a euro. You could type in a dollar. And then also associated software was required. I mean, all these financial institutions in Europe are now going to work in euros. So the word went out and said, hey, get those Indians, let them come and fix this damn thing. You know, this euro business, how do you do it? So as a result of some of that background, here are just some numbers. I mean, we are today doing $50 billion worth of IT and IT services export. It's going to go up to $60 billion. But this is being done on the basis of the fact that India qualifies 3.5 million graduates every year. A lot of them are science and maths graduates and engineering graduates. In addition, 1 million postgrads, masters and PhDs. And these numbers are growing at 10 to 15% per annum. I'll just give some examples of popular software now developed in India. We're not just doing IT services, but we are actually getting into products. Those of you who use Google Enterprise Solutions, that was made in India. The billing and CRM software for the oncoming Beijing Olympics, the poor Chinese couldn't do that. It has to be done in India, so all the software for the Beijing Olympics. We will win maybe one medal, but at least the software goes from India. IBM Lotus Notes. Many, many of you use that. I use it. Also made in India in the IBM Development Center in Bangalore. Microsoft SharePoint. Microsoft Media Player 10. I don't know if you're using music sharing software from Microsoft. Done in India. There are just some examples. This one I like, Radio Mundo. You can actually get internet radio on your mobile phone. It's a very low-cost software, very popular in the United States. I urge you to look it up. Brilliant, absolutely brilliant. And you can get most of the world's radio stations on your mobile handset. You don't really need iPods and whatever else. And one of the most recent ones, the Motorola Razr multimedia software, also done in India. Just to bring in to the right perspective of India and knowledge. Here's the numbers, or at least the percentages, of all high-tech startup companies in the United States that were done by Indians in just in the period 1999 to 2005. 25% of all high-tech companies in that period started in the United States were done by people of Indian origin or Indians. California itself accounts for 39% of the overall number. New Jersey, 37.8%. Michigan, 32.8%, of which 46% were software companies and 44% innovation manufacturing. These are figures I have reproduced from a study done by Duke University. And this is significant, and also for Australia. In fact, my wife is out today working with some school bodies and college bodies. How did this happen? My generation, at the time that we were passing out of the Indian Institute of Technology in India, American talent scouts were roaming around the campuses. Inducements, encouragements, scholarships were being given for Indian students to go to the United States of America. And we did. We went. My country allowed me only $8. It was not enough for me to go from the airport to the university in Los Angeles. So we got scholarships. And it is this mass of Indian students who first went is today the backbone of Silicon Valley. It's the same people who are now working with Indian entities. I mean, a lot of them, of course, came up, became very senior people in the likes of IBM and Microsoft and whatever. And these are the people who are establishing ventures, joint ventures, etc., in India to be the delivery centers where all this, the sales and marketing are done out of the United States, but all the brain work is done from India. I just have some other interesting figures. Percentage of Indians as employees of IBM. 28% of all employees of IBM are of Indian origin or Indians. 22% of all Microsoft employees are Indians. 17% of Intel. 13% of Xerox. Huge numbers. I mean, you go into Silicon Valley, of course, the preponderance of Indians walking down the streets. I can also even say, I haven't used those figures here, but I often go on work to Finland. And this little town called Tampere, which is where Nokia's design and development center is located. Close your eyes, chuck a pebble, you're bound to hit an Indian guy. That many of them working for Nokia. But more importantly, we've seen IT, of course, it's a story, it's been written about. Good money, the dollars per hour are reasonable, but there's something else happening. The dollars per hour in some other areas are much, much higher. And that's in the field of R&D and designing. It's application of IT into something bigger. And here are just some lists of companies, a list of companies which are the major R&D is done in India. I have put in blue some rather interesting companies. Both are Chinese telecom companies, Huawei and ZTE. Huawei is, for those of you who know your telecom, is the nearest competitor to Nokia in the infrastructure space, that is setting up a GSM or CDMA infrastructure. 40% of all of Huawei's employees are Indian. And they're all based in either the city of Bangalore or the suburb of Gurgaon near Delhi. All the designing for Huawei and ZTE is done in India. They take those designs and manufacture them cheaply in China. That's fine. We have no problem with that. But interesting, isn't it, that a Chinese company or two of the leading telecom companies in China have their research and development and designing done in India. 60% of the world's leading product companies, technology product companies, source a part of their technology from India. It's not something that people write about, but this is a fact. India has in excess of 110 integrated circuit chip design entities. the iPod chip, I alluded to that in my presentation yesterday, was designed by this little company in our city of Hyderabad called Phoenix Systems. More than 90% of all DVD players and recorders, the integrated circuit chips in these appliances designed in India. I don't know if you're familiar with this last item here called the Slingbox. The Slingbox is a very interesting little box. It's a set-top box. Americans who travel overseas, if they have a Slingbox attached to their television set at home, on the internet while traveling overseas, they could be here in Australia, they could be in Europe, can access live the ongoing TV programs in the United States at the time. This demand came actually from Americans who were fond of basketball and football and baseball because they wanted to see the games. And most sports channels overseas were not carrying these. So the Slingbox was developed in the city of Bangalore. And, ladies and gentlemen, do you know this little gizmo? It's a little different from the gizmo that you have here. This is the iPhone, the Apple iPhone, recently launched. And what happens in the iPhone? These are the main components within the iPhone, the chips. And you see, all of them have been designed in India. All of them. Given the names of the companies and the cities in which they are located, you can look it up and confirm it for yourself. So this whole business of R&D and designing is now becoming a world-class ecosystem. We expect that by the year 2010, there will be $30 billion worth of exports of just this. This is in addition to the $60 or $70 billion of standard IT. Just automotive, aerospace, and engineering design would be at least $2.5 billion. It was $2.5 billion in 2006. It is increasing by 10 or 15%. By year 2015, of course, all of this has to, you know, we need people to do this. There will be 20 million students in higher learning by the year 2015. 2 million of whom will be engineering students, 75,000 PhDs, 270-plus universities. In the year 2006, there were 1,500-plus Indian R&D and design entities. These are Indian-owned and controlled. 250-plus multinational, not including, I mentioned, the 100-plus integrated circuit design establishments. We have 200 national laboratories. 25% of all global expenditure on research and development is in India. It's huge numbers. These are some of the principal areas of or disciplines where we have R&D and designing going on. Some rather interesting ones. I mean, most of Norway's oil rigs, for example, are designed in India. A company called Larsen & Toubro. And here are some emerging areas of research and development. Three-dimensional modeling, finite analysis, you name it, crash simulation. Last one here is interesting, clinical research. Many, many of the world's pharma companies are doing drug development in India and then take it forward for clinical testing and trials. India, as you know, has climatic conditions ranging from cold Arctic in the north to equatorial hot in the south. So pretty much all the world's climatic conditions are already available in India. Many people on which to try out the pharma, the new medicines. Here are just some names who have actually their global design centers, some companies that you may be familiar with. I put in red Infotech Enterprises, for example, which has designed the Airbus 350. And again, some other familiar names, even Japanese companies like Konica and Minolta, they get their design done. But the interesting one is Ferrari. The new models of Ferrari are being designed in India. The poor Italians find it difficult to do it there in Italy, so send it out to India. And then we have another area, which is what we call knowledge process outsourcing. This is a little different from design and development. Another emerging area, $17 billion exports estimated year 2010. And these include things like legal services or insurance or education training. My wife has some colleagues who, at the end of the school day, can go to this little place where they assist kids in the United States or UK. I don't know if Australia is included, but for them to do their homework or problem solving, it's all done on the internet. And then special coaching, because American teachers just don't have the time now. I mean, they come 5 o'clock and they're away. So these Indian teachers sit in an internet center and help U.S. kids with their homework. So just some areas. I mean, you can think of a subject. It's being done there. Some absolutely weird stuff like movie animation and translation and subtitling. India is the major country in this particular field. And then there's an emerging area called medical tourism. Again, needs a high tech. We believe by year 2012 that will be another $2 billion worth of foreign exchange earning. Very simple, for example, a heart surgery in India, a high-tech heart surgery in a very modern teen hospital certified. Costs only $20,000 against maybe $200,000 in the United States. I've already talked of major drug development in India. To develop a major blockbuster drug, it costs only about $50 million in India, where it should cost more than $1 billion in the United States. And these are figures I have actually got from a U.S. Publication called The Story of Life-Saving Surgery in India. So, let's see what Bill Gates has to say about this. As everyone knows, India has become a global leader in information technology and other high-tech fields such as pharmaceuticals, telecom, and telecom-based business services. One day, we may look back on India's progress during this decade as one of the great humanitarian achievements of our time. The current chairman of IBM, ladies and gentlemen, India is the hub for high-value global innovation. So, as I said in my presentation yesterday, does this sum up India? On the one side, it's a poor country, yes. On the one side, we have a rickety infrastructure, but some things are going. I mean, here's this holy man using a nice Nokia 1100 phone, and the Nokia 1100 phone is another story. It was originally designed for use in India and in Indian conditions and used primarily by truck drivers. Most of India's cargo is carried by trucks all over the country. And these, they have cabins which are not air-conditioned. There's dust, humidity, oil on the floorboards, whatever. So this 1100 was designed for use by these guys. It's got everything. It's got a little torch. It's got dust-proof cover. This thing has become such a hit that India is now the major export base. This is manufactured near the city of Chennai or Madras, and it's now exported globally. So that, ladies and gentlemen, is my presentation. I'm open for questions and discussions. Be critical. Say whatever you feel like. No problem.
The capacity of the Indian government to collect enough tax to put in infrastructure such as roads, railways, whatever, to help with this development, what are the main constraints and timeframes there?
Right. First of all, in terms of actually collecting monies or by taxes or whichever other way, I don't think there's a constraint. We have enough capacity to pay and are paying. The problem with infrastructure is a little different. And I'm just going to touch on two or three aspects. The first problem clearly is that of power. We are short of power and have been short of power, and in the immediate near future, we do not see that situation changing drastically. Why is it so? We have the world's largest known reserves of coal, but the calorific value is horrendous. It's poor, A. B, if you set up power stations using that coal, they do not qualify under even India's own regulations for the environment. So you've got to spend large sums of money in setting up coal washeries to get this coal to be fit enough to be used in power stations. So what are companies or even the government entities in the power business, what are they doing now? They're spending money on importing coal from Australia or South Africa. You can't go on importing forever. And in any case, all right, you bring it to the coast, but the cost of transporting it all the way to inland power stations becomes so much more. So the decision now that the government has made is to establish supersized power stations in a few regions along the coast, which will depend on imported coal. But we need to go nuclear. And I don't know if you read this morning's paper or there was a lovely interview with the Australian, or the chairman of the Australian Atomic Energy Commission last evening on one of your channels. India has just signed, it's a memorandum of understanding at the moment, but it will hopefully become an agreement once it goes through the Houses of Congress in the United States. It's called the 1-2-3 Agreement. And this is for India to be able to use nuclear technology for civilian use. Since the sanctions were imposed first in 1974 and then added on to in 1998, because of the nuclear testing, India has not been allowed to obtain any uranium for power generation. So as you may have read, the Australian government has now approved that once the U.S. Houses of Congress approve the 1-2-3 Agreement, Australia will be supplying the uranium. That, hopefully, and that is what our Prime Minister and our current government feel, that for us is the future. It has problems, yes. I mean, we have to have the safety standards, etc., put in. No Chernobyls, hopefully. But it is green. There are no environmental repercussions. We can get uranium. In any case, we really need it only for 5 or 6 years because India has the world's only known program in what we call fast breeder reactors, which convert thorium into usable fuel. And in fact, the deal with Australia is going to be you supply us uranium. There are only 3 countries in the world with thorium: Australia, India, and Norway. Norway doesn't want to use it because they have plenty of hydropower. But Australia needs this. So the deal that is being made is that we will give you thorium technology, where the generation of power is at a cost much lower than that when compared to using uranium. So here's this power situation. It's a bad situation. The rest of the infrastructure, including roads and development of special economic zones, is a huge problem. India is a democratic country. There is no law which allows you to take away somebody's land unless he or she agrees. It's not like some other country that you have an Olympic Games or you have this, or you say, right, kick these guys out, we're going to build a sports stadium here. You can't do it. I mean, we know of a case, I mean, there's several case studies, but this very nice one, it's in our city of Chennai, called the Mahindra's Special Economic Zone. Mahindra is a very large business conglomerate. They could not get that zone going for 6 years because one tea stall holder had a small piece of land and he refused to sell. He said, why should I sell? You give me a good reason why I should sell. Finally, he sold at a price. We don't know what that price was, but he must have made a bomb. But that's the law. What can you do? So it is a problem. We'll resolve it. We'll resolve it in our own pace. So that's the infrastructure issue. Yes. Again, I urge you to come with the BRIC tour in February. Come to India. The previous lot did come to India. They visited the Infosys Center. Infosys is our second largest IT company, but has a much more modern campus than does TCS. And you'd be surprised at the number of foreign engineers who work in Infosys as employees. They get exactly the same wages as their Indian counterparts. So there is absolutely no differential. A lot of Indians who went to study and then worked overseas
are coming back because the differential in wage rates is not very much. I think the Indian IT industry has not been able to get the message through. The message is that it is not just low-cost engineers sitting there. The fact is that they are doing cutting-edge technology which perhaps cannot be done by somebody else. Let that be. That's why we have the global R&D hubs coming up. That's why it's a rent-to-brain supermarket.
Okay. Right. Thanks very much, Anand, for a great presentation. I think just some of the key takeouts from that. I think there's, clearly what we're seeing is that in India's using the young, highly educated workforce to leverage technology into high-value industries. I think, as you just said, it's, perhaps developing skills that other countries and other workforces don't have. But there's, that is really leading to a burgeoning domestic economy through rising incomes and strong domestic demand. Democratic system in India is clearly a double-edged sword. I mean, it's one of the attractions of India, particularly as a place to invest. But it just means that the pace of infrastructure development, in particular, is slower relative to China. Emphasis. I mean, Anand made reference to the Emphasis campus in Bangalore. It's like nothing I've ever seen. It's the most modern campus you could ever imagine anywhere in the world. It's currently about 30 building complex, going to become 50 buildings. It's a massive, massive employer of people and just out of this world from a technology point of view. And there's also a very strong recognition of the challenges, I think, in India. So thank you very much, Anand, for a terrific presentation. Please join me.